They want me to get rid of my dog. Can they do that?
I'm being fined for leaving my garage door open too long.
What are covenants? Do I have any rights?
Help, I feel like I've left the American zone.
If you want the answers to those questions, join me, Sue Bartholomew, and my guests on The Commons every Saturday from 2 to 3 right here on WBR Fairfax Radio. We'll ask the experts and we'll untangle the truth about what's left of our property rights.
This is On The Commons with your host, Sue Bartholomew. On The Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory membership homeowners associations. Join us as we explore this relatively new world of controlled living, which includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single-family homes. Living in a common ownership development means giving up the American dream. It means giving up your constitutional rights and control over your most valuable asset, your home. Living in a homeowners association means leaving the American zone.
WEBR Fairfax Radio, you're on The Commons. I'm Sue Bartholomew, and joining me on The Commons today we have Clint Goodman. Clint is an attorney in Arizona, and he's also the president and the founding attorney of an organization called the Homeowners Institute, and I was really intrigued when I ran across that. Clint, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I was thrilled when I ran across your website, the Homeowners Institute. I'd really like it if you would tell us a little bit about it.
Sure.
Why you started it, how you started it, you know, all of that wonderful stuff, and what you guys do.
Sure, I can do that. We represent homeowners. First and foremost, I'm a trial attorney, and I work for the law firm that's been doing this for decades. And we've found that there's a problem, not only in Arizona, but across the country, with when it comes to homeowners associations, in that homeowners don't typically understand their rights and obligations in those associations. And we represent numerous clients in court and in trial, and what we found is that we shouldn't even be there, really. If the homeowner had knew, or if the association had known what it could do and what it couldn't do at the beginning, we would have avoided the entire thing. So we found that there was a great need in Arizona for educating homeowners as to their rights and obligations to avoid problems. So we created, I came up with an idea. I thought, you know, I'm going to gather a bunch of attorneys, trial attorneys that have experience representing homeowners against associations. We'll look over numerous cases. We'll look over statutes. We'll look over laws. And we'll bring our experience to the table and create an organization for the homeowner so that that homeowner can access information about their rights and liabilities without having to really go pay an attorney thousands of dollars for an opinion letter. I mean, granted, this organization isn't a law firm, so it doesn't offer legal advice and there's no attorney-client relationship, but it's great in that it's the first forum that I know of its kind, where homeowners can go seek help on some of their issues and receive answers to their questions by either articles or coming to our seminars or by accessing our Ask the Experts section, where they can anonymously submit questions to us and we can answer those questions.
You and all of this is available on your website?
Yes.
Can we give out the web address so that listeners can go check it out?
Sure. It's www.hoainstitute.com.
And we'll put a link to that on my website so that people can find it easily, because I think you're right. I think there needs to be a clearinghouse for information that is hard to come by. And that's kind of a little bit what we try to do here on The Commons, is put information out there and give homeowners access to resources and things that they might need as they go through their HOA nightmare, typically. It is
and nightmares they can be.
Okay. How did you get your experience in HOAs, in HOA law? Because this is a very specialized area. It's a very new area. in the law?
It's developing. I mean, when you look at real estate law, real estate has been around forever since we came across from England. And so a lot of the law is founded in the common courts in England. But when you look at homeowners association law, it's kind of a mix with real estate and corporation law that started only recently. And it's developing as we speak because you have homeowners that are starting to speak up and lawmakers decide to change the law to accommodate homeowners. But I got interested in this area of law after I graduated from law school. I externed for the United States Attorney's Office in both the criminal and civil division, and I saw that there was an issue with homeowners and HOAs. Through that experience, I thought, maybe that might be an interesting place for me to go when I get out of the United States Attorney's Office. And so when I started my practice here in Arizona, I had a couple of experiences with my own HOA.
No, how could that happen, Clint?
That made me think, you know, I really should start helping the homeowner here because, for the most part, you know, I only deal with such a small percentage of people. When you take into account all of the homeowners in Arizona that live in HOAs, I mean, there's over 20,000 homeowners associations, and I only have a very small percentage of those homeowners is my clients. So I see the bad every day. I'm not, and there is bad out there, and homeowners associations can cause a problem, but there are some HOAs out there that are working fine.
As we like to say on this show, but they're only one election away from having everything turn around.
Exactly. You'll get an HOA that's working fine, and 5 years down the road, you get a new board in place, and things are turned upside down. I have, I'd say, at least 25 of my clients right now loved their HOA up until a certain point in time when the new board came into play, and now it's a nightmare for them.
Yeah.
So was
there a steep learning curve to learn this area of the law for you?
For me, yes, there was. I was lucky enough to join a firm where we've already been doing this for years and years and years. And so working with attorneys that do this quite a bit, where it would take a normal attorney a couple of years to get up to speed on this specific specialized area of law, it took me only a couple of months because I had access to knowledgeable attorneys who've been doing this for decades.
And this is so your law firm is a firm that typically represents associations. Is that correct?
No, our firm represents homeowners. When I came to the firm, we had a couple of existing associations. I think our firm represents about five associations. I've picked up a couple of associations as a favor because either the president was my cousin or family member, there's a couple of other associations that I've seen that it's actually better to tell the association how to treat the homeowners fairly as the association's counsel than it is for the home to be the homeowner's counsel telling the association what they did wrong. So our firm represents a total of about five associations now, and so the rest, 96% of my practice is representing homeowners against the HOAs. I'm certainly a private property rights advocate. I don't agree with a lot of what HOAs are doing now, and I think that it violates not only their freedom to contract argument, but in some instances, the Constitution.
Well, I've read some of the stuff that you've written, and I'm very impressed. And I really liked what you wrote. You rebutted something that was written by the Goldwater Institute and Nick Drenius.
Yes.
And who, I guess, opposes any kind of legislation that regulates associations, claiming that it's a violation of the contract law. And you came back with some really good arguments against him, which I thought was really good. You're in a minority. It's very hard to find an attorney who will take a homeowner a homeowner's case against the HOA. They don't want to do it. They don't know, you know, don't understand the law. Don't want to learn it. There's no money in it. It's not like representing the association that, you know, there's tons and tons of money there. But so you're in a class by yourself, I think, or, you know, it's a very exclusive group of people. So thank you for doing that, Clint.
My pleasure.
We're talking to Clint Goodman. Clint is an attorney in Arizona and the president and founder of the Homeowners Institute. And the website there is www.hoainstitute.com. Check it out. There's a lot of good stuff in there. Part of what you do also, Clint, is you do a fair amount of lobbying, right, for the homeowners?
Yes.
Yeah, and you were doing that this morning?
This morning, I wasn't able to get down there due to scheduling conflicts, but I've been down at the Arizona legislature now for quite a bit of my time this session. We're promoting Senate Bill 1162 that's already passed the House 53-1.
Wow.
Yeah, it was pretty overwhelming. And I think it goes to the floor for Senate vote tomorrow, actually.
Tell us a little bit about Senate Bill 1162.
Senate Bill 1162 addresses one of the concerns that I have, and it addresses an HOA's ability to act above the law. What we've found, and it's becoming a more common trend as the years go by, is an HOA will violate one of its rules or one of the deed restrictions in the CC&Rs.
Yeah.
And then once they're sued over that provision or rule, in the middle of the lawsuit, they'll amend the documents to exclude the rule. And then they'll take that that new document to the court and say, Your Honor, there's no longer any rule that we violated because we've amended the documents to exclude it. And some courts have accepted that idea, and other courts have rejected it, but nonetheless, those courts that accept the idea that an association can amend the community documents dismiss the action against them and award their attorney's fees. In other words, they make the homeowner who engaged in no wrongdoing, they make that homeowner pay for the association's legal bills incurred up to date.
They've been doing that for years.
And I don't understand how you can get from point A to point B on that analysis, because their argument is, hey, this is a contract. There's an amendment provision in the contract that allows us to amend the documents. We're just following the contract. But when you look at fundamental contractual principles, we're not talking about associations now. We're talking about fundamental contractual principles that have been around forever. It takes new consideration in order to make a subsequent agreement binding. What does that mean? What it means is if you and I and a third party were to contract, let's say you and I, we want to form a pest control company, and we want to hire Bob to go sell or to go get accounts for us. So he goes door to door and he sells at our company, and we agree to pay him $10 an hour. If you and I were to put in a provision in there that we could change his pay at any time, and we later amend that document to remove his pay from $10 to $3 an hour,
yeah,
that just wouldn't be upheld in court, because Bob had no agreement to that amendment. He wasn't part of the amendment. He didn't agree to it. When he contracted under the contract, he agreed to $10 an hour. Unfortunately, when you take the same example and apply it to associations, courts are saying that's okay. And so Senate Bill 1162 prohibits that.
Thank you. That clarifies it, and that's a very, very good example. You know, what does that do to the argument that, gee whiz, you agreed, you read the documents, you've got to do your due diligence, and you do, and one of the provisions is that the rules can change any time. You know, what does that do to the industry's blaming the homeowner for not having read the documents. The whole thing seems to be ridiculous.
Well, you're right. I think it is ridiculous, but this is why it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous because when you read through the documents, there's nothing in it. Let's say, for instance, I read through my documents and it says that I can build a two-story home. I can take my one-story home and I can convert it to a two-story home. That provision's in the documents I'm reading as I'm contemplating buying the home. Because I see that provision, I go ahead and say, hey, I'd like to make my home a two-story home. So I go ahead and buy in that community. And 3 years down the road, I put in an application to make a two-story modification, and it's denied. And I go to the board and I say, wait, you denied me, but the rule here that I relied on when I bought the property said that I could make these modifications. But then you go to court, and they amend the rules to exclude that two-story allowance or to prohibit two-story homes, and there's no longer that rule there. There was reliance at the time that you purchased the home, but it wasn't on the amendment provision. It was on the fact that you could build a two-story home. And when you look at the amendment provision, it said nothing about amending the CC&Rs to prohibit two-story homes. All it said is that they could amend the CC&Rs. There's a treatise out there called the Restatement Third of Property.
Right.
As far as Arizona is concerned, when there's no precedent in Arizona, we follow the restatement. And the restatement says very clearly that amendments to CC&Rs are proper unless it infringes on something that was relied upon, an express provision that was relied upon in the past. So, in other words, if I'm going to amend the community documents to prohibit two-story homes, and there's an express provision that allows for two-story homes, then the amendment provision has to say that I'm going that the amendment can, or I'm sorry, that the CC&Rs could be amended to prohibit two-story homes. It has to have that language in there to put me on fair notice.
Oh, it can't be a blanket. We can change the rules midway down your journey through HOA Hill.
That's my interpretation under the restatement approach.
I'm going to throw something out at you that's not Arizona related, but it got a fair amount of publicity at the time. There was a similar case out of Florida where, you know, there was no prohibition against renting out your condo. And at one point, all associations decided they really didn't want rentals. And so they changed the rules, and they told a couple of investors who'd owned in there for a long time that they had to sell their investment properties.
Mm-hmm.
And they said no, they were grandfathered in because when they bought the place, they had the express right to rent, you know, to rent it out. And it went all the way up to the Florida Supreme Court, and their argument was upheld until it got to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, whoops, but you also agreed that the CC&Rs can be amended, and they just were, so you lose. The industry has been sort of blowing that horn all over the place.
Yeah. You'll see that argument. The Supreme Courts across the country are ruling that way. And I think it's unfortunate when there is such a reliance and when you have an investor that's been investing in property for years and years and years. Now, most of my understanding comes from Arizona law, but you can also look at the statute of limitations argument. I mean, if in certain states you have a statute of limitations that prohibits you from bringing an action after that statute of limitations expired, effectively the grandfathering language can help you to maintain your right to continue utilizing that property as a rental property.
Apparently it didn't in this case, and I don't know why, but that's being used as a precedent across the country, which I think is sad. What can we do about that, Clint? Is there anything that we as homeowners can do?
Contact your local and state representatives. That's what you need to do. That's what we all need to do. Unfortunately, right now, the lobbying power in these in any state's legislature is one-sided, typically.
Yeah, it is.
And I just this is my first session where I've gone and started to argue on behalf of the homeowner before the lawmakers, and really I'm the only attorney down there that represents the homeowners. Everyone else down there either represents the management company,
right,
or the association, and they have a very well-funded organization that has a lot of money where they can pay these attorneys to lobby full-time. And so it's important for homeowners to contact the lawmakers so that the lawmakers can understand there really is a problem. We need to start speaking up more, because right now the lobbyists that represent the associations and management companies are painting a picture like the world is a utopia society with associations, which just simply isn't the case. So the more homeowners that speak up, the more lawmakers will understand that the laws need to be changed to prohibit the amendments we're talking about, to prohibit the association in Florida from prohibiting rentals when people have been relying on it for years, to prohibit an association in Arizona from amending the community documents to exclude two-story homes when people have bought in reliance on that provision. I mean, look at it this way. There are many people in an association across the country that if the rules allow for a two-story home, they're going to build a two-story home. If the community documents are amended in 10 years down the road to exclude two-story homes, does that mean they have to tear down the second story?
That was my question.
under the Florida Supreme Court analysis, arguably yes. I haven't read the Florida Supreme Court decision, but from what you're telling me, it sounds to me like arguably they wouldn't be grandfathered in, because grandfathering argument carries no legal weight, and therefore they'd have to tear down the two-story home that they relied upon. I think it's absurd.
This goes to your example that you used and I read about, where you have the provision to allow two-story homes, and some of the people there who voted to change it already had a second story onto their homes.
Yeah, the people that are voting to prohibit the two-story homes, some of them are people that have already built the two-story home.
And now what happens if you go and tell them to take that take the two-story down, the second story down? You know, presumably if they've banned them, they're in violation, right?
I'm sorry, you cut out. We're over the telephone, so
I'm sorry.
I had a bad connection there.
I'm sorry. What I'm saying is if... You know, now that they've banned the second story, presumably some of the homeowners with a single story can go and force them to tear down the story that they've put up because they're now banned.
Well, it's an interesting question. If I had a homeowner that came to me, one of the two-story homeowners that came to me and said they're trying to tear my two-story down, I would certainly say that they're grandfathered in. You can't do that. And I think that I would have a good argument, and I don't think that any court in Arizona would require somebody to tear down a two-story home that was approved in the past, that's no longer approved anymore because of some amendment.
We're talking to Clint Goodman. Clint is the president founder of the Arizona-based Homeowners Institute. Arizona has the Office of Administrative Hearing, OAH, that was set up a few years ago. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. A couple of years ago, we found that a lot of the homeowners didn't necessarily want to go to court to resolve their concerns, either because it was costly or because it just took a long time to get from filing a lawsuit to getting a judgment. It took years and years. And so lawmakers addressed that concern and created the Office of Administrative Hearings process. Essentially what they did is they opened up an administrative forum for homeowners where the homeowner can go file a petition and get some relief. The administrative forum does not award attorney's fees, and one of the reasons for that is because they want to keep the attorneys out of the picture. For better or worse, I mean, I don't go down there very often because my clients won't get reimbursed. But in any event, It was meant to expedite the process. These judges, these law judges, were given authority to resolve concerns, to rule whether there's a violation of the community documents, and to tell the HOA what they need to do to fix the violation. And for a year or so, the process has been running pretty smoothly. You'll get into the OAH, and you'll get a judgment from them within a matter of a couple of months, not a couple of years like it takes in court.
Attorneys are allowed in there then. It's not like small claims court where you have to go in pro se.
Yeah, you can go as an attorney. I've represented clients there before, but the difference between that and small claims court is in OA, you can represent them. You're just not going to get reimbursed your fees, your attorney's fees, if you win.
What's the scope of what the Office of Administrative Hearing can listen to? I think that they're limited to the law and CC&Rs.
Yes, you're right. They're limited to the Planned Community Act and Condominium Act in Arizona, which is just essentially another word of saying condominiums and homeowners associations. They're also limited in scope to resolving only issues related to the CC&Rs. And they do not hear complaints from homeowner to homeowner. It's only disputes between the association and the homeowner. But there is currently an appeal that is challenging the constitutionality of this whole process.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there was an appeal from an administrative order issued by the Office of Administrative Hearings. And in the appeal, it's challenging the fact that the Office of Administrative Hearings can issue injunctive relief against an association. The attorneys for the Homeowners Association are arguing that it's kind of a separation of powers argument, because OA is more of the executive branch, not the judicial branch. And what they're arguing is that the executive branch is effectively acting as a judiciary, and therefore...
Isn't that what happens in associations every day?
Yeah, it's a head-scratcher, but, I mean, the Attorney General sat back and said, hey, we can't allow this, so they actually just filed a brief saying that it was a constitutional process and the executive branch can be delegated some judiciary functions, and it's fine. And we're still waiting for the decision. If the court rules that it is unconstitutional, it's almost hopefully it will be appealed to the higher court. And if the higher courts rule that it is unconstitutional, then it's back to the drawing board for the lawmakers.
Oh, my goodness. So, wait a minute. This is interesting. And I'm wondering what's going to happen. And they can't say that, gee whiz, this is, you know, it's a contractual relationship. You agreed to come into the OAH? I guess not, huh?
Well, yeah, I don't think so. It was created by statute, not by the CC&R, so I can't really say it's by contract.
So were associations. I mean, you've got so many statutes out there regulating associations that it's really hard to call them contractual relationships.
Yeah, I think that with as many statutes out there that are regulating homeowners associations, I think they're important, and I don't necessarily think that they infringe on one's freedom to contract, because there's common law issues that govern how you can contract anyways. I mean, we can't contract for illegal purposes. We can't contract, enter into a new contract without new consideration. There has to be offer, acceptance, consideration, all these legal terms that govern whether you have a binding contract. So it's the same thing. In HOAs, it's statutes that regulate whether you have a proper contract. And in the world where there's no HOA, it's the common law principles.
You know what? I'm going to use an example that we have right here. I live in an older association that does not include any language anywhere that says that the association can fine me. There's a Virginia Supreme Court Gilman, Unit Owners Association versus Gilman, that finds fining to be unconstitutional. after that decision came out, the legislature went in and gave associations the right to fine for alleged violations of rules and regulations, and then to foreclose non-judicially to collect that fine. That's not something that we agreed to, yet it's something that's been imposed on us by the law. And it doesn't say that we as homeowners have got to all sit there and amend the governing documents to do that. It says that the board may adopt a rule giving the board the power to fine and foreclose.
So, I think the example you give is a perfect example where the statute actually hurts the homeowner.
It does.
And that's the perfect example. It supports what I'm saying. Homeowners need to get out and express these concerns with their lawmakers and their representatives, because if you were to walk over, across the street and go visit your local representative at your state's capital, you're probably going to find that the only ones down there that are lobbying this full-time, these issues, are the attorneys that represent associations and management companies.
Oh,
so when this court came down with this decision, rest assured it was these lobbyists that were saying we need to change this, and so that's what happened. And luckily for us in Arizona, that we have a similar statute, but it helps the homeowner typically rather than hurts them, because there is already an implied fining power, but our statute actually places restrictions and hoops on the association that they have to jump through in order to fine somebody. So I think that in every state you're going to find it a different analysis.
Yeah. There are two cases that I know of. One of them is the Gilman case, and the other one is the Foley case out of Rhode Island. And by the way, both of these cases are on my website on thecommons.us. But the Foley one says that it's the law that's unconstitutional, the law that empowers association. It's an illegal, it's an unconstitutional delegation of a police power.
Yeah. Unfortunately, there's no state that I'm aware of right now in the United States that deems an association a state actor subject to constitutional restrictions. There was, for a time, a case in New Jersey that imposed constitutional requirements on an association, but the Supreme Court in New Jersey overruled.
Twin Rivers?
Yes, Twin Rivers. The association overruled the Court of Appeals decision, but they came to the same conclusion. They held that what the association was doing was wrong, but not under a constitutional analysis.
Yeah, I had Professor Frank Askin on, and we've covered that case. Gosh, we've covered it all the way through as it went through the court system for years. That was a very unfortunate decision, I think.
There are a couple of initiatives that I'm aware of across the nation where homeowners are trying to put it to citizen vote to subject associations to the Constitution. And it'll be interesting to see where that takes us, because a lot of people are trying to get it done through lawmakers and through Congress, but they're not really getting anywhere, so they're bringing these initiatives to petition and to citizen vote. And if that's successful, then I think once we get homeowners that are starting to do that, we're going to see a major change in the United States with respect to what associations can and can't do constitutionally, which would be nice.
What states are these, Clint?
Well, our state, the idea has been floating around for years, but it's becoming more serious. I wouldn't be surprised if we saw a petition floating around to put it on the ballot next year, or within a couple of years at least.
Wow, that's interesting. That's worth keeping an eye on there. We're talking to Clint Goodman. Clint is the president and founder of The Homeowners Institute, an organization out in Arizona, has got a website at www.hoainstitute.com. Please check it out. And you're on the Commons. This is WBR Fairfax Radio. And that means I have got to be Shu Bartholomew, which I think I am. I was the last time I looked. Clint, I was watching, there's a little video on one of your clients, Marlene Bagarozzi, is that her name?
Yeah, Marlene Bagarozzi.
Bagarozzi. You want to tell us a little bit about Marlene and what happened in that case? Because that's something that I hear about a lot, by the way. ADA and fair housing violations all the time.
Yeah. Well, to start off, I think every one of your listeners should view the videotape footage. Austin Hill is the reporter that did a great job on the case. Everyone can view it at www.hoawebtv.com. I would recommend anybody and everybody go view that because it's a perfect representation of the nightmare case. In this instance, Marlene Bagarozzi is a disabled, wheelchair-bound widow who, when she was looking for homes, a retirement community, she wanted to come to Arizona. She wanted a beautiful desert mountain view, and the only homes in the desert with a desert mountain view were HOAs. And she read the rules like any responsible prospective buyer would, and she found that she couldn't park an oversized van on the property. That oversized van was necessary to accommodate her disabilities. It had handicap-equipped wheel controls and some other accessories that she needed to accommodate her disabilities. So she went to the developer and said, I can't buy in here unless you guys allow me permission to park my van in the property and grant me a variance to your rule. The developer, who at the time represented the HOA, said, oh, sure, that's not a problem. So they signed an addendum to the contract, the purchase agreement, that allowed her to park her van in a designated handicap spot. She went ahead, got the agreement signed, purchased the property, went on living what she thought would be a wonderful wonderful place, and a couple of years later, she started receiving notices from the association that they were going to tow her van. She sent them a letter and said, excuse me, and she gave them a copy of the purchase agreement and a copy of a signature from the HOA at the time, the developer that allowed her to park there, and the management company came back to her and said, oh, you know, we're sorry, we told you to move your van. Our fault. Have a good day. A couple of years later, that she got the same letter from the management company that said, remove your van or else we're going to tow it because it's oversized in violation of the rules. Again, she sent them off the contract with the developer's signature allowing her permission to park in the handicap spot in front of her home, and they sent her a letter back and said, you need to move it. We don't care what this says. You've got to move it or else we're going to tow it, and we're going to start fining you.
Lovely so, people, right?
At that point, she came to me. She plopped the contract on my desk. I looked over it. And I just started scratching my head, to be quite frank. I thought, this is just one of those cases where you have a management company that has no idea what they're doing. By the way, management companies aren't regulated. You don't have to have any formal education. So you have management companies operating running a multi-million dollar operation with no formal education, and you run into problems like this. Because they don't know what they're doing.
But even those who have all kinds of education and credentials are just as bad, Steve.
They can be. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. Oh gosh, that you know, being educated is no guarantee that they're going to know what they're doing. Trust me.
No guarantee, but at the same time, it certainly helps reduce. At least if this management company was aware of the laws, we wouldn't have ever reached this problem because it was very clear that she had permission to park in this spot. So anyways, to make a long story short, I drafted up a demand letter and said, Marlene has every right to park in that spot, and not only is that right in her contract, but it's codified in the Fair Housing Act. because under the Fair Housing Act, associations have to provide accommodations for the disabled. And if they don't, then it's discrimination on the basis of disability. And they snubbed their nose. They snubbed their nose at me as well, and so we had no choice. We had to go to court. And
oh, you did go to court.
Yeah, we went to court, and after about 8 months of litigation, we obtained an order from the court that she be allowed to park in this spot. But meanwhile, mind you, she doesn't have a van. She can't get out, and so she's effectively under house arrest. You'll see in the video when she talks about how much of an impact that has in her life. She can't go to the grocery store. She can't go to her doctor's appointments. She can't even visit her husband's gravesite on their anniversary.
Yeah, that was a very emotional and poignant moment when she talked about that. Obviously, it really bothered her, and as it should.
Yeah.
She made a very interesting point, Clint, that I found interesting anyway. The association did not believe that it was a handicap van because she didn't have handicap license plates on it. She said she didn't want to advertise the fact that she was handicapped.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good point, because that sort of puts you at risk, doesn't it? If somebody who's out to do no good notices that you're a woman, you're alone, and you're handicapped, does that put you at risk?
I would think so. I mean, it all depends on the area you're living in. This particular area, Marlene had every right not to put handicap plates on the van. The HOA knew that it was a handicap equipped van because it was the one signing the addendum to the contract in the very beginning. So she didn't need handicap plates. The HOA, through the developer, didn't require them. This was just another one of those arbitrary steps that they imposed on her in an effort to control her life.
So you went to court, and they're leaving her alone about the van now, right?
As far as I understand, yes. But that doesn't mean that they've stopped.
No.
I don't know if have you seen the whole video where they're talking, where they send out the rule about the cat?
Oh, I did. That's what I was getting to. So they lost on the van, and now they've decided that they're going to change the rules on the cats.
I haven't seen whether the rule has been placed on the books or whether it's just a proposition. But nonetheless, they've sent out to the members this either proposed rule or rule that prohibits you from having more than 3 cats in your home or prohibits you from having dogs in your home. Interestingly enough, Marlene's cats are housebound. They don't go outside. They're never seen on the street. They're in the house. This association apparently is trying to control what Marlene does within the confines of her own home that they have no right or shouldn't have any right to control. It doesn't affect them. And also, the other point that I wanted to make with that rule was, I don't know of anyone else in the association that has cats, but when you say you can't have more than 3 cats and Marlene has 4 cats, who do you think they're directing the rule at?
Oh, I know.
Or towards?
Oh, I know. Oh,
and at
I
the
know.
Same time, they place a number on the amount of cats, but they don't place any number on the number of dogs. They just say you can't have dogs. So, I mean,
is this a covenant amendment, or is it just a rule?
I don't think it's a deed restrictive amendment. It's more of a rule.
But the rules, as far as I know, the association is given the power to adopt rules that pertain to the common areas, not the inside of your house.
Yes, rules have to be reasonable and have to be authorized by the deed restrictions embodied in the CC&Rs. And even if there's a provision in the CC&Rs that limits or restricts your ability to do something within your own home, let's say the CC&Rs say I have to have a Whirlpool refrigerator instead of a GE refrigerator, that would be deemed void and unenforceable because it has no relevance to the benefit or well-being of your next-door neighbor or the common area that's shared by everyone. It's just something that should not be regulated by homeowners associations. And this cat issue, in my opinion, shouldn't be regulated either when the house, when the cats are housebound. I mean, if the cats are going outside and moseying around the common area, that's a different issue. But when the cats are housebound, the HOA has no business trying to regulate that.
Of course, California has the Narstad case, which I'm sure you know about.
Yes, and that's why I said when you have a CCNR provision that deals with the prohibition of animals, that prohibition is valid only in so much as it affects the common area or the common enjoyment of other owners. But there is no reason why somebody should have to prohibit what you do within your own home when that does not affect anyone on the outside doors of your home.
Let me go a little bit off topic here, not too far off topic, but if you're talking about a high-rise situation where you have one story above another, and I don't know if you have too many of those in Arizona. You didn't when I lived there. But we hear a lot of that here from people. And the buildings are not built very well. You don't have adequate insulation. But yet, because of that, I mean, there's clearly a problem, an issue, when it affects the person below you. But can there be a requirement that you insulate so that people can reasonably enjoy their homes? You can see both sides, and
yeah.
And I'm hearing from both sides. You know, it's my home, and this is the way I want to live in my home. You have every right to do that. I live below, and, you know, the noise is bothering me.
Right. When you look to the restatement, the treatise we talked about earlier,
yeah.
The restatement gives the HOA the right to regulate activities within one's home that affect the quiet enjoyment of an adjoining neighbor.
I understand. And if you turned on the stereo and you ran it, we're having a bit of a thing here. If you ran the stereo out very loudly, I can understand that happening. But if you're just walking.
It's an interesting point you raise. In fact, I've got a client who came to me last week and said, I'm redoing my patio. I wanted to convert it from turf to tile, and they say I have to put in an insulation barrier between the two that's certified by an engineer as to soundproof qualities. And they said, can the CCNRs require that? And I said, well, probably so, yes, as long as if you went downstairs and you heard the pitter-patter of feet without the sound structure, you could probably prohibit that. But it all comes down to what's reasonable. If you can't reduce the noise to eliminate the common walking across your living room, not stomping across, but just walking across your living room, if you can't eliminate the noise entirely, then I don't think you should be fined for walking across your living room. It just doesn't make sense. Again, it comes down to what's reasonable and what's not reasonable. What the common person, the common everyday person does in their life, a common everyday person walks across their home, and the common everyday person shouldn't have to be fined for doing that.
Oh, I know. I mean, I've heard from people saying, you know, I don't like the fact that my neighbor uses XYZ brand of laundry detergent because the smell I find annoying. So I mean, they get down to the point where they absolutely want to regulate every single little tiny thing. And I think people like that who cannot live with a neighbor and put up with some inconveniences should be out in the middle of the woods, but they want to live there and they want to send their neighbors out in the middle of the woods where they can't annoy them. So that's not the best situation at all.
Yeah, I'd rather live in North Korea in a totalitarianistic state than live in an HOA like that.
Oh, they're all like that. At some point, they're all like that. Every single one of them's like that. What's next, Clint? What's on the agenda? Once you've got this bill passed, you said it's passed the House?
Well, it passed the House. It came over to the Senate. It hit a snag. Our governor, Napolitano, said it'd likely be vetoed, so we had to amend some of the language. Because we amended the language, if it passes the Senate tomorrow, we have to send it back to the House again for final approval. And then it will go off to the governor for signature.
What? Why would it be vetoed? I mean, it doesn't sound like there's anything there that...
Well, the bill addresses three problems. One, it addresses the amendments we discussed about already. We talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. The second thing it does is it addresses attorney's fees and awards of attorney's fees in courts, where the court is considering an appeal from an administrative order from OAA. What we find, and I don't want to get into too much discussion about this because I don't think it's what you want to talk about, but we found that sometimes when an HOA loses at the Office of Administrative Hearings, they appeal to the court, the Superior Court, to get their fees back. And because the Office of Administrative Hearings is not awarding fees, the court on appeal shouldn't have to award fees either. That's what Governor Napolitano was concerned about, because the original language in the bill said that the Office of Administrative Hearings can award attorney's fees if there's misconduct on the part of the HOA or the homeowner. And the Office of Administrative Hearings didn't want to address attorney's fees, period. And so they asked Governor Napolitano essentially to veto the bill if it passed the Senate. So we just basically had to amend the bill to exclude OAA from the picture entirely.
Is there a requirement that the prevailing party is entitled to awards of costs and fees, or is it just the association?
Mind you, we're not talking about court actions. We're just talking about the administrative action before OAA and an appeal from the OAA administrative decision. In court actions, when you go straight to the Superior Court or to Justice Court, another court in the states are called small claims courts, you typically are entitled to attorney's fees if you prevail. But the opposite is true. So if the homeowner goes and they lose, then the HOA is likely going to have that judgment ordering the homeowner to reimburse them for their fees.
I also saw you had written to Mr. Vernell, is it?
Yes.
Vernell.
Yes.
He had some concerns about this.
Right. Mr. Vernell is the director over at Office of Administrative Hearings. His concerns were what I just discussed. They don't want to have to consider attorney's fees, period. And, again, the language of the original Senate Bill 1162 allowed the Office of Administrative Hearings to award attorney's fees if there was misconduct on the part of one of the parties. And so we had to amend the bill to exclude OAA from that whole thing.
So that was his only concern then.
Right, that's his only concern. He didn't have any concerns with regards to the amendment language that we talked about earlier, where the HOA amends their documents to avoid liability in court.
That's unbelievable that they would do. I mean, I don't know why I say it's unbelievable, but, you know...
I just had a case up in northern Arizona 2 weeks ago where just after we had argued and we had prevailed on our motion, we represent the homeowner again, but the HOA's attorney walked up to us and said, well, since you won this one, I think now our next step is just to send out an amendment and amend the rule to exclude what you're fighting over, so then we can get this thing dismissed. So be expecting an amendment to the CC&Rs. So... That's their next step.
That's their next step, huh?
And hopefully we can get this law in place before they do it.
That's ridiculous. And when do the laws typically go into effect in Arizona?
In September.
In September. So if it passes now, it'll be it'll be in effect in September then?
Yes, unless there's some other language put on it that makes it effective December 31st.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, but I don't anticipate that happening.
Good luck with that, Clint. Thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it. I appreciate what you're doing. And I hope you'll come back again sometime.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. I'd be more than happy to visit with you again.
Let us know how these amendments or this new bill is helping out. We'd really like to follow up on that.
Will do.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for joining us today. Please check out our website at onthecommons.us. That's onthecommons, all one word, .us. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions. Thanks again for joining us, and see you all next week.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to justice for HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet, the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Well, we're not afraid or stupid, all your threats mean nothing here. Time marches on, soon you'll be gone, united we'll be there. So put your rules and CCRs up where the sun don't shine, and enjoy those precious golden years, stop messing around with mine. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.